We like to snooze in the morning. We like to snooze all day. We like to snooze whenever we choose, snoozing our cares away.
Sandra Boynton is one of our favorite guests on this program. She comes by whenever she has something cool to talk about or just when we beg her to. Well, she has something new to talk about, and it's a very cool board book. It's called Dyna Snores. It is out from Workman, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Sandra Boynton back to the roundtable. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you so much for having me back.
Very nice to have you back on the program. So from what I understand from reading the author's note in the book, this was something where you worked on a bedding, from what I understand.
Yes. 20 years ago, yes.
20 years ago, there was Sandra Boynton Dyna Snores bedding.
Yes.
But the only thing that you didn't have was the origin snory.
Snory. I like origin snory. I'm going to use that. I'm going to claim credit for that as well.
The origin story of the Dyna Snores, that had not existed prior to this.
They just sprung full-blown from the head of Zeus originally.
So how did that come to your attention, or did you always know that and you think, oh, well, now maybe it's time to fill in the blanks?
No, I actually was looking for, this is very prosaic, I was looking for a pillowcase and spotted the Dyna Snores one under the pile and remembered it and remembered that my son Devin had absolutely loved this particular pattern. I later found out that he actually still has a set of these sheets that he uses. I didn't know that. But then I thought, why didn't I ever make this a book? It's a good idea.
First of all, did you like seeing your stuff on sheets?
Oh, I designed everything.
I never
actually licensed my things in the way people usually mean that. No one else has ever drawn any characters of mine.
So it's always been your stuff.
So it's always been my stuff. So when I designed sheets, I actually designed them. I mean, I learned how to do repeats and chose the colors and did the outline.
And that must have been pretty cool.
It was. It's really fun.
Yeah. And then the creative mind comes up with Dyna Snores.
Yes. Well, I guess stumbles on it, yes.
Okay. And once you're on that, then that's just funny in and of itself.
Yeah, I like the word Dyna Snores. It's good.
Then you come to write the story. So tell us a little bit about, because this is, it's rhyme and it's lovely. It's a very sweet board book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think as you can guess from the title, it's a go to sleep story. And as all of my books are, it's short and kind of, you know, someone recently said, oh, are your books poetry? Because they don't scan quite. And I said, well, then I guess they're more like songs. They're more like music in a way that doesn't scan in the sort of rigid way poetry might. And I think this book follows along that. I eventually, when the person said that, I then looked back at this book and said, oh, it's waltz rhythm. But I don't do that consciously. I do what sounds right. So it has a very lulling sort of rhythm to it, which gets suddenly derailed by the Dyna Snores. Once they finally sleep, they start snoring. And so there's one page that has nothing but the word honk shoe written four times in bold, sort of primary color type against a black background. And that's where the entire sleeping aspect of it gets somewhat derailed by the relentless noise of the Dyna Snores.
It would seem to me you would have to know something about the child's mind of what they're interested in, or is that just from practice of being a mom?
Oh.
In the sense of, you know, that they're going to latch on to, like, honk shoe is just fun.
Right. People have asked me that, whether I sort of tuned into children. I think most children's book writers are absurdly tuned into themselves as children, have vivid memories of being a child. So I have no trouble being in a child's mind. I have a lot of trouble understanding the adult mind thing. So I don't tend to write for adults. So really, first and foremost, I write these books for me as a child. And that's sort of my best access point.
Have you always felt most comfortable? That's basically the same question, but have you always felt most comfortable with animals as opposed to humans?
Oh, well, it's got more of a theatrical component to it in a way. I don't, it's a little hard to describe. for one thing, I can draw animals much better than I can draw people, but it frees you from deciding what the age, gender, race, size is of a character. And it's just you're in the sort of quiddity of the character. So it's just a better, a better iconography. I don't know, something like that.
So when you hit a bonnet, as far as, was the hippo the first or what was...
Oh, my very first published book was Hippos Go Berserk.
And you figured, okay, well, this is funny. I can draw a great hippo, and this looks good.
Well, I did. My oldest sister, Judy, absolutely loved hippos from the time she was very little. So, you know, when I drew hippos, they were for her. Interestingly enough, I then became associated with hippos, and everyone kept giving me all kinds of, you know, hippo memorabilia, which I felt a little bad about because it really properly belonged to her. I mean, I love hippos too, but she, you know, my older sister and I adored her. She was the hippo lady.
Is there certain animals that worked for you and ones that maybe not as much? Pigs seem to work for you. Chickens seem to work for you.
Yes. I mean, you know, it's hard to, you don't want to base a story on a mosquito. It's unlikely to have the sort of universal appeal.
Is not going to be as good.
You know, it's just not. No, it's interesting that the animals that are intrinsically cute, I don't think I can draw as easily or as well as ones that have a kind of, I mean, pigs are cute, but they're not as cute as, say, you know, a gerbil. And I don't think I'd be very good at drawing a gerbil. I finally got a guinea pig this year. I finally drew a guinea pig. But it took quite a while, actually. It took me hours to try to figure out.
Now, do you do that as a challenge? Do you think, I'm going to
nail down the guinea pig? This is my, doing a 2021 calendar, which is, you know, and I was actually a little late for it. This was a couple months ago. And it's a fabulous holidays calendar, meaning it's got 365 actual, you know, like National Static Electricity Day, which I'm sure you know is January 9th. Everyone, you know, and
everyone
obviously
does.
Static Electricity Day Eve on January 8th. So I came upon, you know, International Hamster Day, and I go, well, I don't know how to do that. International Guinea Pig Day. So that's what I just said, okay, I'm going to work on this. I'm going to figure out how to put a guinea pig on International Guinea Pig Day.
And you got it.
Yes.
Yeah. At the end of this book, I like it because we hear all about the dinosaurs from the beginning. It's the dinosaurs, and we learn about their snoring and them dreaming. And then the last page is a bunny. The rabbit is saying, I like all the dinos, but I want to say, thank goodness those dinosaurs live far, far away. I think it's nice to have this narrator, if you will.
Yeah, it's the first time I've ever only had the narrator in a book appear once, and it's at the very end.
Yeah.
It actually was a challenge I ran into as I was writing the book. I was thinking of, omniscient narrator that you were never going to see. And then but if you get to the last page and you're saying, I like all these dinos, but I just want to say, you need to actually see now who your narrator is. So that was a surprise to me to go, oh, I have to figure out exactly who the narrator is. So I don't know why I landed on a bunny, but it seems to work as a surrogate for a child. There's something sort of childlike about this particular rabbit.
I love the ears.
Oh, thank you. See, it's great. Because I knew Joe Donahue would love the ears, and I said, I know what to do.
Sandra Whiten is our guest. The new book is Dino Snores, and it's out from a Workman. In The New Yorker said about your work, Sandra Boynton's board books are not mere trifles, but rich works that all of us can and should enjoy. I'm interested in your thoughts on the board book and what they can be.
Ah, it's interesting, by the way, as a side note, when I first saw that New Yorker piece, because I didn't know about it ahead of time, I actually thought he was kidding. I thought he was making fun of me.
I think it's a compliment.
I eventually realized it was. Board books are important partly just as a physical object. It's a great object for a child from 0 to 3. You know, you can chew on them. They're non-toxic. They're easy to handle, easy to turn the pages. So just as, an artifact, it's an incredibly engaging thing for a child. Yeah. And the length is good for, you know, the board books that I do for Simon & Schuster are 7 spreads long. The ones I do for Workman are 11 spreads long. They're short, but they're, I shouldn't say but, and they're, and you can still get an arc in them. So they really do work like a short song, like a, you know, from the jukebox era, kind of your 2.5 minute song, your 2 minute song. They have that kind of self-contained appeal, and almost all of my books are in rhyme, and I think rhyme is important for young children. It has a sort of lulling quality. I think it's good for their language development. I think it's good for their, you know, for their brains. I don't have any research to back this up, so you're just going to have to take my word that my belief that it's true makes it true.
Do you know how many you've done?
How many? Well, I've done over 60 books, but I don't know how many of them are board books. Maybe, maybe 40 something.
But a good number.
Yeah, a good number, a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so that to me would then make you an expert on that subject.
Okay, good. I'm an expert on this subject.
I would say so. You talk about song. It was the second time that's come up in conversation, and we should note that besides this beautiful work, you also have made a lovely career out of doing unconventional children's music. 6 albums, I believe?
6 albums, yeah.
6 albums. Yeah. 3 of them have gone gold.
Yeah, well, 3 went gold and 1's gone platinum. Philadelphia Chickens is now platinum. I know.
It's
when
amazing.
Did I ever think I'd have a platinum album on my up on my wall?
So how did you get into that? Was it because these things work so well as songs?
Yes, it was. I have 4 kids, and when the youngest went off to school, so she was 6 at the time, Darcy was 6, as they were growing up, people would give them, as you know, birthday presents, children's music. And I think in general, I don't know how to be entirely diplomatic about this.
It was horrible.
It's horrible, yes.
Yeah, it was just horrible.
Joe Donahue says it's horrible, and who am I to argue with him? No, children's music is terrible. I just felt that it had to be possible to do something that was genuinely music and that would be just as pleasing for adults as for kids. It wasn't condescending and cutesy, and so I was pretty determined to figure out how to do that.
So in that determination comes these partnerships with these amazing artists that you get to do this project with you.
Yeah, no, it's been truly unbelievable. I can't believe I got away with this. I've gotten to work with almost all of my favorite musicians. It's incredible.
Now, is it a tough sell in the sense, or do you just say, look, this is what we're doing for kids, and do you want in?
There's a complex answer there, because I can't get to the artist directly, and managers are meant to be...
difficult.
Yeah, gatekeepers and difficult. Yeah. And I think they're also perplexed that they're hearing from me rather than my organization. I don't have an organization. I don't have an agent. I don't have an attorney. I'm the organization. And to me, that's important, but it can make people think this must be something minor. But once, you know, if people listen to the demo I send, I always send a demo, and it's always specific to the artist. It makes sense for that artist. And if people have kids, then it's a relatively easy sell for me because they already know my work. If not, just getting someone to listen can be a little difficult.
So let me just put a momentary pause in this conversation and go back to the idea of no manager or any of that. Was that obviously as a conscious decision, and you said, okay, there's control there.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Actually, you know, my sons and I were just talking. You know, we took a road trip together, and we were just talking about, as soon as someone represents you, they're misrepresenting you, whether they intend to or not, because they're not you. And that just doesn't work for me. I would just rather represent myself.
And that way it also has no impact on your art.
Yeah, exactly.
And your creativity, I should say.
So I get to choose who I want to work with and how I want it to go. And, you know, and I'd certainly rather be rejected or accepted on my own terms rather than misrepresented. And as I say, it doesn't have to be deliberately misrepresented. Just it's the nature of someone acting on your behalf.
So pressing the play button once again on the children's music question, Brian Wilson, Brad Paisley, Kevin Kline, Casey Musgraves, Blues Traveler, Meryl Streep, Spin Doctors, Davy Jones, Dwight Yoakam, Patti LuPone, Neil Sedaka, Weird Al. Man.
Yeah, man is right. I just by a series of odd coincidences, I just met a couple of weeks ago Yo-Yo Ma and had the extraordinary experience of him having said to me, could I play on one of your songs? And, you know, you just go, oh, I don't know. Can I hear an audition tape or something? And who knows whether that will come about. He's an incredibly in demand, busy, superb musician.
But he asked you. I mean, there's interest there, obviously.
No, it was, yeah, it was.
Are you working on more albums? Is that something you want to do?
Well, I will now. No. I hadn't known, you know, this is a strange time for music and how to get it out there. You know, my music has always been sold separately as download now and even separately as a CD, but its primary sales have been as a songbook combined with a CD. And that's worked very well for me because people who are looking for my books are going to encounter the music. And that was the right, you know, but CDs are on their way out, not as quickly as people thought. There's been a little bit of a resurgence, but how do you sell the music is a complex question.
But we assume we'll figure it out, right?
Oh, yeah, you and I are going to figure this out. I'm staying here all day until we figure this out.
But if you have a book and there's a place where you could even, through a download or through a code, you can then get the song or something like that, that could work, right?
It could. The thing about getting a unique code for each download into the book and then people being angry that they don't actually do music online and all that, it's not like I haven't thought about it and talked about it a lot. It's complex.
It is complex. And as far as artists, they want that control too, right?
Yeah,
they want control.
Yeah, and understandably, yeah.
Yeah. When you look back at your work, though, is the children's music a special proud moment? Especially proud moment?
It's actually my favorite thing to do. Just absolutely favorite thing to do. I had originally thought I was on the path to become a stage director. I love the theater and I love directing. And to me, that's actually what's ended up happening is, you know, I produce all of these tracks. And I absolutely love being in the recording studio. You know what it's like. You know, it's exhilarating. So I've ended up being a director that way, as a music producer, and working with artists I just have, you know, infinite respect for. So it really has been my favorite thing to do.
And the there's the artistic element, of course, to it in the packaging, but in the songs, it's your words. Those have to be two loves, right? There's the music, then the words, and then, of course, the
In most cases, I'm writing the words and the music, not the orchestrations. I work with Mike Ford, who's, you know, we work side by side doing the music production, which is a different thing than producing the recording. Mm-hmm. But in terms of actually putting together the track, you know, we do that side by side together.
What word do you like to describe you? Artist, cartoonist, illustrator?
I say cartoonist because accurate gives you the most accurate impression, although then people say, have I ever seen your strip? And you go, no, I don't. You know, so there actually isn't a word.
Were you ever, I assume people asked you to do a strip? Or
that's a long story.
Okay. All right.
But it has to do, though, with the terms of that were very much relinquishing control. And so it just was never going to work for me.
What about the deadline? Was that something that you were worried about?
I mean, I know you have to work 6 weeks ahead of time and all that. That not so much. I mean, I like to work. No, it was that if they didn't like the content, they could hire someone else to do your strip and then charge it against your tiny portion of what the strip generated. It was truly the worst contract I've ever seen in my life. And it wasn't just that I wouldn't sign it. I was livid that they were using their power to get beginning, and I wasn't a beginning cartoonist, but to get beginning cartoonists, you know, it was such an unbalanced contract. And so it wasn't just that I didn't want that contract. It's that I didn't want to be dealing with people who dealt with artists that way.
Was this at a time sort of what we would say before the decline of the of
yes.
the cartoon and
yes.
the newspaper?
Yeah.
So that says a lot about the industry, though, doesn't it? And then you've been able to forge your own way.
I think it says a lot about the industry, and I think the same thing is true with the music industry. I don't think it's just the change in the way people get music. I think they dug their own grave to some extent as well.
Realizing that I'm going out slightly on a limb here because I don't have any facts to back it up, but when
I'm comfortable in that realm.
When I think of cartoonists of either strip cartoonists or panel cartoonists, I can think of only three or four women in that field.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't tend to think that way. I don't know. I think growing up in a family of four girls and going to a Quaker school, I think I was especially lucky to just, you know, a Quaker school very much just stresses individual efficacy. So I don't think I was ever thinking of how am I going to do this in a male world or anything. It just wasn't relevant.
That was never a barrier for you?
I don't think so. I don't know.
It seems, so in our conversation, we've talked many times, but in our conversation, it seems like with that control comes a pretty nice lane that you can go down and say, all right, this is what I want to do,
yeah.
And this is pretty much all I'm going to do is what I want to do.
Yeah, it's a good lane, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not without its frustrations, of course, but it...
No, but to just, I think the only good advice, you know, because people ask you for advice of all kinds of things, I think the only thing I'm sure was good advice, and I don't remember who it was, but I said... You don't have to know what you do want to do. You do have to know what you don't want to do. So if you do something I don't want to do this, but this is a stepping stone to get to somewhere, I don't know. I think that's risky. I think you just have to say, no, this doesn't work for me. This doesn't feel right.
Does ignorance, and I use that word in the most highest sense of the word, meaning of going in and saying, okay, I'm going to design sheets.
Right.
Does that, of not being a sheet designer, does that help you, do you think, of saying,
oh,
okay.
I think naivete it can be a wonderful asset.
naivete, by the way, probably a better word than ignorance.
Okay. We'll
go with that.
I wasn't correcting you. I first started by selling my own cards. I was still in college. I was just trying not to be a waitress again. So it was a summer job, and I was lucky enough to have an uncle who was a printer, so he sort of extended me the credit. So I went around selling my own cards to stores. That was a huge plus. And man, was I naive about you're supposed to have an appointment and you're supposed to, but I didn't. And I think people, I mean, I was 20 and I think I looked, you know, 15. So I think, most of the buyers in stores, especially like department stores, tended to be men in their 30s, 40s. And I think that, you know, the receptionist thought it would be funny to break up the day by sending in a kid to show these cards.
And then the cards start to sell.
Yeah, and the cards did sell. And if I showed them to you right now, you'd be really surprised that they did, because I'm surprised that they sold, but they did. And so by the time I was, so when I was on my way to graduate school, I knew I couldn't keep also, you know, running a business. And that's when I went to a trade show somewhere between my senior year and going to grad school in drama, and found a company that of a sort of compatible sensibility to take over the business part of it. And so lots of serendipity in my life as well.
And then do you consider that you had a big break? Like there was the moment that was the big break for you?
No.
Yeah.
Does that seem like an odd answer? I don't
know.
I mean, I think I've been lucky to meet the right people.
I mean, I've had it described to me as the big break is the time when it goes to, I have to do this to, I want to keep doing this because I enjoy it.
Well, I guess since I was still a student, I didn't have to do it. And maybe that was also lucky. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I wanted to do it. I liked it. I certainly didn't want to go back to waitressing. But, you know, I went to graduate school I had a fellowship. So I didn't need it to be the work I was doing yet. So I never had that time that it needed to be, you know, my work.
And there has to be gratification.
Oh, I like gratification.
Gratification. There you go.
It's good.
It's a good new song. It has to be gratifying that you then, as I said before, that people respond to it, that people like what you're doing and that there is a success.
Oh, it's very, very gratifying. Yes. It's, you know, you certainly never know if you're going to connect with people or not. And my stuff is certainly quirky. And, as you know, I'm not a naturally skilled cartoonist. I've learned how to do it, but I wasn't one of those kids who you'd look at the drawings and say, oh my goodness, someone is going to be an artist. I wasn't that person. Other than I think my work was appealing and authentic, but not skilled in that way. I think actually that's turned out to be a good thing for me. It gave me my own space. So I think my limitation, and it's a definite limitation, turned out not to be all that much of a detriment.
But also that sparseness has a beauty and a creativity, and it's
I guess
in and of itself.
Yeah. If you can't draw the backgrounds, then it's kind of nice to have work. You say, you know, there are no backgrounds in this work. It's really very pleasing. It's very zen, you know.
But color comes in, obviously.
No, color, yeah.
And the bright colors and certainly appeal to children.
Yeah. So, yeah, there is a kind of, and I think the reason my work appeals to very, very young children, which when I found that out, that really surprises me that, you know, a 3-month-old baby responds to the visual. It doesn't surprise me that they respond to the sound because their minds are ready to respond to sound and to voices and to cadence. But I think it's something about the black line that for some reason wires into a very young child's perception.
The new book is just out. It is called Dino Snores, and it's published by Workman, and it's just a delight.
Oh, thank you so much. It was so much fun to draw it.
It looks like it was fun to draw it. Many more projects on the way, I assume?
Always. I'm not exactly.
Not to mention a calendar.
Yeah, well, the calendar's finished for 2021, so look for it everywhere a year and something from now.
Is there a 2020 calendar?
Oh, yeah, there is. That's been out
good.
For a while now.
Oh, okay, all right. I don't know the calendar market.
I know.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry at all. Why should you know the calendar market?
Is it a page a day? I had one of your page a days there for a while.
I did a couple years of page a day. It's way too many drawings to do for something that will last for a year. It was hard.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I did it for the 2 years. And I just...
Enough of that.
Enough of that. No, I would really like to figure out a way to do some more music. And I need to give it some more thought of what that best way is going to be.
Well, you and Yo-Yo.
Okay.
You kids get together.
Yeah, you see what we can come up with.
Let us know when you got an album to sell.
I'll let you know.
The new book is Dino Snores. It is out from Workman. Sandra Boynton, it's always a great pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. Such a pleasure to talk with you, Joe.
Thank you. Again, Dino Snores is out by Sandra Boynton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.